60s, and he, it's my poor Talmud, it's his second marriage. He buried his first wife, and he's going through hell again. God have mercy. They added a name, Ruchama. Ruchama Peril Malka Lea Bat Chana Seril. Okay, we're ready to begin the world to do. Are you ready?
Let me just start recording.
This meeting is being recorded.
Ah, welcome, welcome. I brought the picture. We'll talk about it at the end. Okay, today is Monday, October 19th, 2020, and we're all davening for Refuah Shleima from the Makar and all those that are ill. And in addition, all of Yeshiva University, the Rabbinical Council of America, the Orthodox Union, want to dedicate whatever words of Torah will be said today for Refuah Shleima, for Rabbi Lod, Jonathan Sachs of Great Britain, Yaakov Tzvi Ben Liba. I don't have to tell you that Rabbi Sachs is one of our most elegant spokesmen, a fabulous philosopher, deep insight, and he has an advantage. He didn't grow up in a rabbinic home. I know the family. And he somehow has avoided all rabbinic politics, kol hakavod lo. And the Eibishter should have mercy on him, on us, and send him a total refuah shleima. I want to quote Rabbi Asher Weiss speaking to Yeshivat Har Etzion a week or two ago. And he was asked, who is a perfect Jew? And he answered, I quote, he should have a litvisha cup, chassidisha head, integrity of a yekka, tamimut of a Hungarian Jew, covered a Torah of a Sfardi, and the love of Eretz Yisrael of a Dati Le'umi. That would be a perfect Jew. And believe me, that's what we should strive for. I say to Rav Asher Weiss's description, a very hearty amen. If you recall, a number of weeks ago I mentioned to you that when we were growing up, Ne'er Yisrael was always one step behind YU, but in its openness, it was more open than any other yeshiva. And I said the word, it was rumored that Rabbi Ruderman was a college graduate. And in addition, I didn't even say this in class, but I should say it now, I remember it was rumored he was a handball champion. Anyway, my Talmud Rabbi Francis spoke to someone who's married to Rabbi Ruderman's granddaughter, Rabbi Elin Feldman of Atlanta, and he wants everyone to know that he never heard of anyone claiming that Rabbi Ruderman had a college degree, and stated conclusively that such a statement is erroneous. Nevertheless, I said it was rumored, at least in my circles in YU, and it reflects, in other words, no one ever spread a rumor that Rabbi Aaron Cutler had a college degree and was a handball champion, although we found out that he was a bucky in Russian literature. That's something we found out much later from his youth. But no one ever stated Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, but Rabbi Ruderman, that was the rumor. So I don't want anyone to think it's a fact, but that's what we heard in our time. On yesterday's shir, I got already a number of comments. First of all, it's not to correct myself. I fell into a trap living in Israel 52 years. I spoke of Shmini Atzeres. I should have spoken of Simchas Torah, but in Israel that word doesn't exist. It's Sukkah, Shmini Atzeres, and Simchas Torah happens to be an addendum to Shmini Atzeret. But Reb Heschel's concept of covering the Sukkah applies in Chutz Laretz to Simchas Torah, Shmini Atzeres. A Litvak has to eat in the Sukkah. That's the big difference between the sinful Hasidim who eat in the Hamad. I've given them the Shurim on this. It's not for now. But they go against an open Gemara, Yetev Yatvinin, Marech, Loma Barchina, and the Gemara, it's Mem Zayin Amad Aleph and Sukkah. So it's not that I correct myself, but I want to be more accurate. I meant Simchas Torah of Chutz Laretz. Jack asked me a different question. he told me a story that someone told him that they were eating at the home of a Litvish Rav, and second day Rosh Hashanah, he had a rimon on the table. And he went out of his way to say, don't think it's because of simanim, you know, rimon, we should, yibu b'neinu kemo rimon, like the pits in a rimon, skuteinu, mitzvateinu. No, it's only because of the sveika of Yom HaRichter, whether we have to say a shechiyanu or not. So Jack asked a simple question, why are the Litvakim so opposed to concepts like this, simanim, and you know, the answer is you have to be a Litvak to understand that. I think it's the same reason why Reb Chaim Briska and everyone coming from his school of thought didn't kiss their tzitzit during Kriyat Shema. And I know I once said this in public and people gave me other reasons. The other reasons, as Rabbi Yerucham wrote, is a hin and a hair, but this is nish the yisod. The yisod is very simple, that a Litvak was kulo, intellectual, and ceremonies, little ceremonies that really have no source in Shas and Paiskim, they couldn't tolerate. Well, you're kissing your tzitzit, it turned them off. I don't want to go further. I don't want to quote Rabbi Yerucham Gerelick, but he could be pretty vulgar in telling off kids who walked into class with their tzitzit out, or if they, chas v'chalila, kissed the mezuzah, Rabbi Yerucham went into orbit. And I'm an eyewitness. I don't want anyone to tell me, you know, they make up stories that Rabbi Yerucham never taught in Yeshiva University. He only came in occasionally to give musa. That's art scroll thinking. It's like the latest issue of Hamodia, the English magazine or the English newspaper that comes out once a week, that some people get all their news from it. So this latest issue talks about the Pittsburgh Rebbe's funeral, and it says, of course, everyone kept their distance at the funeral. And I tell you, it's shocking to me how you can lie when the whole world saw the videos of the funeral, which Rakef had told his friends, his family. It's incomprehensible. The Pittsburgh Rebbe dies of corona, and at the funeral, thousands of Hasidim pushing, shoving, no mask, no distancing. Ribbono shel Olam, where are we at? And then Hamodia comes out and says, and of course they kept their difference. That's like the book that says, and of course Rabbi Aaron Cutler's sister was from, but lo aleinu, she was a Mizrachiite. Or halavai, she would have been a Mizrachiite. Okay, I don't want to get aggravated. Let it stand. All right, let's pick up where we left off today. It's a very important moment in Torah history. The implications of what happened affect us until this very moment. And if you notice, you'll take Shira Chadasha, you'll take Drisha's innovative minion, you'll take Chovevei Torah and their various graduates, and David Goldis, some of them are not Tzaddikei Yesod Olam, and they've made many different innovations. But no one has taken down a mechitza. It's amazing. You go to Shira Chadasha and people tell me there's a mechitza right down the middle, a woman will lay in, a man will lay in, a woman will daven Kabbalat Shabbat, etc., etc. I think they now allow Mariv, they say it ain't a Tfilat Chova, but there's a mechitza. And this goes back to the Rav. And here what I told you before we broke is very important to understand the Rav. The Rav went through a very difficult period in the 30s into the 40s. He had to Americanize. Look, you've come in Aliyah, those of you that are integrated into Israel. It's not an easy process. I came in Aliyah. Imagine someone would have told me as I got off the boat in Haifa in 69 in Motzei Shabbos at about 10 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock at night, some would say to me, you're going to serve in the army for 15 years, you're going to work for the Mossad for 10 years. I would look at them, wow, integration. But all right, this is a country of immigrants. The country is built upon immigration. They're prepared for it. They go out of their way to help. When you dial the Kupat Cholim, they'll ask you what language. You press 1 for Hebrew, 2 for Russian. I don't know if they have an English. It could be English, French. It's amazing. And you come into an office If you don't speak Hebrew, you'll see people will stand up and, who can speak English here? The company is geared for it. A friend of my wife was telling us that she was buying vegetables in a vegetable store in Rehov Aza. And another friend of ours who doesn't speak Hebrew called and wanted to place an order. And generally there's a lady who works there who knows English. There was no one there. So the person who owns the store asked, does anyone speak English? And this lady who was there, Ruth, she's native English from England, she took the order. And this is only in Israel. You follow, the country's geared for it. But you come to Boston, 1932, and the country is not geared for a greenhorn, for a big Talmud Chacham, for someone who stands on principle, who cares about halacha. And the Rav went through a very difficult period. By the mid-50s already, he's the Rav. What happened? Min Shemayim Zachinu, yeah, we see a Bostonian putting on a Boston Red Sox hat, Baruch Hashem, and by the mid-50s, he's the Rav. And he's prepared to come out in public. Now, when these two cases took place, New Orleans and Mount Clemens, they brought an expert testimony into the court. Expert testimony on both sides, conservative rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, the OU got involved, and they brought in letters that were statements from Gedolei Yisrael. Obviously, you don't want to drag Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein. You don't want to drag them into court, but they made statements, issued letters. In addition, the Rav issued statements to the Rabbinical Council of America. By now, he's totally integrated into RCA. Agudas HaRabbanim remains a footnote in his life, and he is at home. There are some real difficult problems here. The most difficult problem, and this is something that you can't comprehend today, the RCA, perhaps 20-25%, it might have even been 30% of their membership had mixed pews. So how come the Rabbinical Council, how can they fight against taking down a mechitza if their own rabbis have mixed pews? And this was one of the problems the Rav will deal with. And it's a very delicate problem. And you'll see there's a certain sentence that comes up where you'll see the Rav is very clear. There are other problems involved. The conservative movement did not lack for well-known Rabbanim who knew how to learn. They knew how to learn because they had studied in Yeshiva Shkol Chanan. They were products of American yeshivas, not only Yeshiva Shkol Chanan. I don't want to sound prejudiced. Chaim Berlin graduates, Teira Vadas graduates. When I was Rav in Lower Merion in Philadelphia, one of the most prominent conservative rabbis was a Teira Vadas graduate. I need not tell you, Rav Moshe Scherer's brother, Harry Scherer, I believe it was a younger brother, I may be wrong, it could be it was an older brother, you can correct me if you know. Harry Scherer was a Reform rabbi, and not stum a Reform rabbi. He actually was Masada Kedushin, I'm using it in a popular lingo. He performed marriages for non-Jews and Jews, and this is a Teira Vadas graduate. Okay, well, we can go on and on. There are many examples. But these people came in, and also imagine they gave testimony that religion changes, religion develops. You understand the conservative movement, the historical approach. And there are changes. For the sake of argument, when lo aleinu, you sit shiva, you don't cover up your head today. That's an interesting question. Why don't we do it? So you'll see it's brought down in the halacha that the goyim would laugh at us. The Rav had a more basic answer, that we wear a kippah today, and the kippah is atifat rosh. But if you want to nitpick, you can give many examples. So you'll see the Rav alludes to all this in his statements. Now, I want to quote from the volume, The Sanctity of the Synagogue, Baruch Litwin. And I knew Baruch Litwin. I met him a number of times. He was a man, I don't know if he was a Baal Tshuva or always from But here was a man who had a business. Again, he, by today's standards, he wasn't a billionaire, but he was well off. His business, I believe it was a lumber business, and he was successful. People who build need lumber. You don't go out of business. And when this issue came up, he devoted his entire life. He spoke to Rabbanim, he collected material, and he put out a very beautiful volume which is quoted and requoted. It came out, I know of two editions, there may have been more, The Sanctity of the Synagogue. So everything I'm quoting about the Rav is in The Sanctity of the Synagogue, page 17. And remember, this is the Rav's English. You have to give credit to a man who comes to America. His native language was Yiddish. He learned Hebrew. He learned Polish. He learned Russian. Russian, Polish, German. Greek and Latin, university. And then he has to come to America and learn English. And you got to give credit. The man was a genius with languages. Let me reiterate in precise and unequivocal terms, I'm quoting from page 139, with regard to the seating arrangement in a house of worship, the separation of the sexes in the synagogue is a basic tenet in our faith. It dates back to the very dawn of our religious halakhic community and constitutes a pentateuchian injunction. He puts in parentheses, Issa d'oraita, which can never be abandoned by any legislative act on the part of a rabbinic or lay body, regardless of its numeric strength or social prominence. And here, of course, what the Rav is talking about, and this is lo aleinu, what we face today in the modern world. How many Jews are shown the mitzvah? Go back to the 1950s. Ben-Gurion, you know very well, exempted 400 yeshiva boys from the draft. He figured they're the last remnant of what he saw in his youth, and in 25 years, 50 years, there won't be a yeshiva boy left in Israel, there won't be a frum boy left in Israel. Who could believe the rebirth? But you see, psychologically, we are influenced by our upbringing. And all of us here were brought up, taught democracy at the age of 4, the age of 5. You don't realize it. You went to gun. You went to kids. It's not like today, the mothers all work. The kids already are in Ma'on at the age of Fikveis, right after the lady ends her maternity leave. The kid is in Ma'on, what is it, 4 months, 5 months, lo aleinu, and yet the kids turn out good. I can't, but I always say, don't look at my grandchildren, and many turned out fabulous, but they had grandparents nearby. That was the difference. It wasn't just that the mother was working, but there were grandparents, grandmothers, don't let me give myself credit, let me give my wife credit, who took over. And so you're in kindergarten. You're 4 or 5 years old. And the teacher says, well, dear children, it's a beautiful day today. Should we go to the park or should we go to the museum and see paintings? And she puts it to a vote. And obviously, there are 25 kids in the gun. 24 kids vote to go to the park. And Yomos, the only kid, voted to go to the museum and see the paintings, all right? And this is why Yomo is a genius today and knows so many different things. You have no idea. He plays with my office. He's with Musk. Musk. He's with Musk. Who the heck is he? The biggest genius in the world. I don't understand one thing about him. Yomo was right there. My grandson did a PhD in biology with cells at the Technion. I brought it into my office. I showed it to two of my Talmidim who are very big PhDs in science. They didn't know. It's not their field. Yomo looks at it. 10 minutes later, he gives me a summary of what my grandson is writing about. All right? Yomo, relax. If I want the facts, I'll tell them to you. Just relax. But you get the message. At the age of 4 or 5, you don't even realize it. You're learning democracy. And this affects our entire life because we grow up. And we always figure the majority is right. And it's very hard. When I was growing up, to be a Shomer Shabbos Jew, you were overwhelmed. The whole world was against you. All the numbers were against you. And this is what the Rebbe is saying. I quote further, what was decreed by God can never be undone by human hands. And this is an answer to the conservative movement, because they'll say, we innovated here, we innovated there. Once again, Hillel T. King Prisbel. Those of you that have read conservative propaganda, the whole conservative movement is built upon Hillel T. King Prisbel. But they don't know how to learn. If you know how to learn, open the Gemara, and you'll see, Prisbel bizman hazeh, shmita is only derabbanan. Once something is derabbanan, there's more leeway for the chachamim to innovate, to make gezeirah, to make takonot, etc. But you have to be a lamdan. But when God decrees, and this goes back to the dawn of the Jewish people. And here the Rav says something very interesting. And he's, absolutely correct. In my opinion, mingling of the sexes is by far a more flagrant violation of a great principle than installing an organ or praying with bare heads. Unfortunately, while every traditionally minded Jew understands that the latter practices tend to strip our synagogue of its Judaic quality, on a tantamount to an attempt to Christianize our ritual, many well-meaning and sincere Jews are being misled with respect to the mixed seating arrangements. And here, just think for one moment. What's wrong with Clay Zimmer in the synagogue? What's wrong? What's the whole Issa of playing a guitar, of playing drums, of playing a trumpet on Shabbos? It's an Issa derabbanan, Shemi Yitakein. In the Beis Hamikdash, you had music, right or wrong? I'm quoting now Rabbaran Haran. He was one of the first reformers, was a Gaon Adir, and he wrote a whole sefer. He said, I just said Rabbaran Haran, you see, I gave him cover. I should say Aaron Haran. He fought the Chatam Sefer. But he was a lamdan, and he said, if the shul is a migdash ma'at, let us play an organ in it. What's wrong in the Beit HaMikdash? Look what the Levium did on Shabbos. Interesting. So the Rav is right. And yet people, you say, put an organ. I don't know how many, are there any conservative shuls that have organs? Maybe, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's very few. And somehow that turns them off. But the mechitza, infinitely more important. The same thing with the kippah. Today, we all wear a kippah. You remember in Providence, Rhode Island, the rabbi who was friendly with Rabbi Belkin, and he went through a whole ceremony after the Six-Day War, reformed temple, but you now have to wear a kippah, Jewish identity. You're right, I don't want to play down what a kippah means. Today, it's a very important symbol of male Jewish identity. But on the other hand, halachically, you can be the greatest Jew in the world not wearing a kippah. And yet, in a conservative temple, I don't know of one conservative temple where they're not going to give you a kippah, a skull cap to put on. And the separate seating is infinitely more important. Now, listen to the next paragraph. I wish to state that I do not know of any Orthodox rabbi or Talmudic scholar of high repute who would dare to say that mixeding is in consonance with our law. Neither the Orthodox rabbinate of America, consisting of three major organizations, and I'm saying this in parentheses, RCA, Agudas Rabbanim, Rabbinical Alliance, nor the chief rabbinate of Great Britain and its dominions, nor the rabbinate of the Holy Land, would even vaguely suggest that such a practice is permissible. What's the Rebbe referring here to? There's a big difference from being rabbi of a congregation with mixed pews when your attitude is, I want to change it, I want to help, my Rebbeim allowed me in. You know, you would talk with the Rebbe, you would talk with other Rabbanim in Chicago, they were very lenient, Rabbi Regensburg. But no one ever said it's permissible. There's a big difference. You're trying to influence, you're trying to inspire, you're trying to change, you're trying to elevate. But no one ever said it's permissible. The requirement for separation is halachically so elementary and axiomatic, historically so typical of the synagogue in contradistinction to the church since antiquity, and philosophically so expressive of our religious experience, that whoever dares to question this institution either is uninformed or consciously distorts religious realities. And this is the Rav that goes back, and he's going to give sources in a minute. It goes back to the dawn of our history. And this statement, remember, this is Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. This carries weight. This is the Rav. Everyone is listening. And here, all of Orthodoxy stands united. You have the Agudas HaRabbanim, the OU, the RCA, a Rabbinical Alliance. All right, the Agudas HaRabbanim can only play a minor role because their Rabbanim at that point in time, they didn't have one prominent member who could speak English or speak English properly without an accent. Reb Lazer Silver could speak. I can tell you, for instance, Reb Lazer Silver was the most Americanized, right, in my time. Reb Moshe Feinstein, you never heard him give a talk in English. Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, all right, he spoke English, but Yiddish was his ballpark, of course. Reb Aaron Cutler, you never heard Reb Aaron Cutler give a talk in English. But even Reb Lazer Silver, B'didi HaViyuv, to record this for posterity, I spoke about it over the years, but let me speak about it again, put it into context here. There was the Lumshi Yeshiva alumni in Petach Tikva. There was a Lumshi Yeshiva. As a matter of fact, the Petach Tikva Lumshi Yeshiva was the first real Litvashi Yeshiva in Israel. That's where Rav Shmuel Rozovsky taught. Panovich was built on the framework of the Lumshi Yeshiva. It pulled out some of the top Talmidim, and Panovich caught on. Lumshi Yeshiva, I don't know if it still exists, how big it is, but it's certainly not anywhere near what Panovich is today. But they wanted to raise money in America, so they decided to honor Mr. Norman B. Abrams. Norman B. Abrams ran Yeshiva Shemitzchal Hanan, the legendary Mr. Abrams. David Tversky, in your time he was still there. You remember him? I don't know who else, the old timers. David, you remember him? Am I right? Shake your head. All right, David shakes his head. He remembers him. I don't know if anyone else can remember him. You remember him, Charles? Charlie remembers him? Wow. And one second, Dove, you have to remember him too, in your time, right? Okay. So, Mr. Abrams, why did they pick Mr. Abrams? It's a fabulous choice. Because Mr. Abrams' father was the mashgiach of the real Lumshi Yeshiva in Lumshi. His father was Rabbi Avram Paka. And in America, the name Paka didn't go well, so he changed his name in honor of his father, Abrams. That's how his name becomes Abrams. So Norman B. Abrams is fabulous. He's the old father, Lumshi, and YU, the modern, and they have two guest speakers. Who are the two guest speakers representing two different worlds? Rabbi Dr. Emanuel Rachman and Reb Lazer Silver. It's a fundraiser. The idea was to raise as much money as possible. So Yeshiva University got involved and made a big contribution in honor of Mr. Abrams, and all the Rosh Yeshiva are guests. We're brought by the Yeshiva. It paid for us, it contributed, and to honor Mr. Abrams. All right, here I am. I think it was at Riverside Plaza, if I remember correctly. And Rabbi Rachman speaks. What language does Rabbi Rachman speak in? In English? And then the Mechabed Reb Lazer Silva. And Reb Lazer Silva gets up. A bezun from mein chaver, Reb David Rachman, can redden in English. Ich will eichet. If the son of Rabbi David Rachman, my good friend, Rabbi Rachman, Emanuel Rachman's father, is speaking in English, I'm going to speak too. And he starts giving a pilpul in English. 20 minutes he goes in English. But then when he breaks into the crescendo at the end, and if an emphatala taritzin, he's answering the difficult Rambam, breaks into Yiddish. You follow? You saw. The same thing happened in Israel. No, can anyone tell me when that happened in Israel? In Reb Shach's famous talk, whether they should join with the Avodah, what was it, in the early 90s? Remember the famous talk in the Skaka Stadium in Tel Aviv? And filled, and there's Rav Shach speaking in Hebrew, and when he gets emotional, he breaks into Yiddish. He couldn't go on in Hebrew. You could see what his native language is. And I can still remember Reb Avadya Yosef was sitting there, Hulo mevin milah b'Yiddish. The Belzer Rebbe is leaning over. It's fabulous to see. The Belzer Rebbe is leaning over and he's explaining to Rav Avadya in Hebrew what Rav Shach is saying in Yiddish. Right, I know the whole talk by heart. I can tell you exactly what he said, but it's not for now. But the Rav, here is the Rav speaking. Here is the Rav. Now, if you notice, the Rav suffered from one fault, and this it is absolutely true when you go back to anything he wrote in English or Hebrew. His main language that he picked up in his formative years was German. He went to university in Germany, got his PhD in Germany. How many of you have studied German? Germans are famous for run-on sentences. I studied German. They can write a sentence, 50 words, totally normal. When I got the contract for my first book, the editor of JPS, Jewish Publication Society, Chaim Potok, Zichrono Livracha, sat with me, taught me how to write. One of the things he taught me, you break down your sentences. You're not writing German. And if you notice, the Rav, he can write an English sentence, 50 sentences, 50 words. I had the problem when Larry Kaplan translated Ish Halachan to English. I later cited part of it in my work on the Rav. I thank Larry in the introduction. I asked Larry permission, if he doesn't mind, if I edit some of his translations, because his translations were literal, and he wound up in English having 50 words, like the Rav had in Hebrew 50 words. If you read my work on the Rav, whenever I cite it, it is in better English, and that's what Chaim Potok taught me. All right, now, then he goes on, and in the next paragraph is something I spoke about. I'm not going to read it word by word, but the Rav took the viewpoint that what is required by the Torah is separate seating. Miriam and the women daven separately. The men daven separately. That's what's required by the Torah. Separate seating. The concept of a mechitza is a rabbinic concept. The Rav refers to the Mishnah in Avot, Perek Aleph, Mishnah 1. The old maxim, the Rav says, make a fence around the Torah. And this was the Rav Shita, and he remained very loyal to the Shita. As I said last time we met, this became a tremendous machlokes between the Rav, I mean, in theory, the Rav, Rav Moshe, the Satmar Rebbe, Rav Tzvi Yehud the cook, how high does a mechitza have to be? And all right, this is a machlokes that lives on until today. B'diavad, the Rav was mater a 50-inch mechitza, even a 40-inch mechitza. Lachatchila, the Rav agreed with the Satmar and with Rav Kook that it should be 72 inches like it is in Maimonides. But here the Rav is just explaining that the conservative rabbis threw at the Orthodox that there are many shuls where you have separate seating, you don't have a mechitza. Well, that's an innovation. So we're innovating a little bit more. And I told you, in the Bronx, the tremendous shul on the Grand Concourse, Concourse Center of Israel, I mean, some of you may remember it, was a majestic building, and there was separate seating. It was a shtala that was always held by a JTS graduate until, I would say, the 40s. Then already it was all YU graduates. And they didn't have mechitzah, they had separate seating. The Beis Medrash downstairs, which had the Hashkama minyan, and afterwards the youth minyan, there was a mechitza. But upstairs there was no mechitza. Separate seating, I remember it like yesterday. And the Rav, all right, this is not an innovation. It doesn't puzzle the shul. It's not that you can say, we took the mechitza down, so we're going one step further. We're letting them sit together. Chas v'chalila. Okay, on page 141, the Rav answers, and this is very, very sharp. In conclusion, let me say it is completely irrelevant to our problem whether 50 or 5% of the membership of the Rabbinical Council of America occupy pulpits in synagogues with improper seating arrangements. See, he's responding to the conservative charge. Listen to this. The violation of a religious or ethical principle does not affect its validity and cogency, even though a large segment of the community is engaged in doing so. A transcendental tenet is binding regardless of its unpopularity with the multitudes. And listen to this last sentence. Was the commandment against murder declared null and void while the Nazi hordes were practicing genocide? And that's a very sharp statement, and it makes you think. And absolutely, this is one of the greatest tragedies imaginable, that Hitler came to power legally. There was nothing illegal about Hitler's rise to power. And here you have the Rav absolutely right. When people say to you, I don't know, those of you who are out in the field of Rabnit and Kirov, and people say, but Rabbi, 95% of the Jews in this community are Mechallel Shabbos. You have to answer very strongly, it doesn't make it right. I wouldn't use what the Rav said here to a tyro, to a beginner, because it's too sharp. In other words, when you speak about Hitler, as if the Seichel of Shabbos is like Hitler, it's too sharp. But when he's a little bit into it and understands, Vic, then you have to open his eyes. Majority vote doesn't make it right. This is the Vah Hashem Zu Halacha, not majority vote. Okay, this is letter that the Rav wrote. Page 109, this is a very famous letter he wrote to the Rabbinical Council Convention. And you'll see why this letter is so widely quoted. The Rabbinical Council of America stands now at the crossroads and must decide either to assume boldly and courageously the time-honored, by ages sanctified role of the traditional rabbinate, which traces its history back to Joshua, Moses, and Sinai, and thus be prepared to fight for an undiluted halacha, which is often not in the vogue, or to deteriorate in a so-called modern rabbinic group of undefined quality, of in a confused ideology, vague in its attitudes, and undecided as to its policies. My dear friends, my dear students, Yeshua, if you write English like that, you'll be arrested. That was one sentence. I think I had 100 words there. But you see, what the Rav is dealing with here, it's this whole problem, RCA, 5%, 10%, 20%, 30% of the members have mixed pews. If you let them remain members, how can you fight? How can you say that mixed pews forbidden? Come on, be consistent. And he's talking about an attitude, talking about the ultimate commitment. You see, in one of the shuls, I think I mentioned to you, the rabbi never spoke out because he was afraid of losing his job. So his attitude was, if they want some excuse, as long as I can remain here. And you have to understand, the rabbi comes to a kehillah, he makes an investment, he lives there, his kids grow up there, his wife is happy there. I know one rabbi who was a graduate, he was younger than I am, he's not alive. He was in my brother's class, Yeshiva College, one of the last to leave YU and go to JTS. And he was rabbi in a big conservative temple out in the island. Four children. I taught four out of the four. And one of them is a very close Talmud, very well known in Israel today. Terrific individual. And three of the four are totally Orthodox. Two out of the four, or even three, I don't know, could even be three, I don't think so. I think it's two out of the four live in Israel, his daughter and one of his sons. And that rabbi died young. His wife remained in the community. I don't want to mention the name. In Long Island, in a conservative temple, a frum woman. But she was there for 30 years. Her roots are there. Her friends are there. She was the Rebbetzin there. It's very hard. You have to understand. It takes guts to say Ad Kan and pull out, particularly if you're popular. It's not that they're throwing you out. They like the rabbi. But rabbi, please don't intervene. Don't interfere. We're modern. This is the new world. And the Rav says the RCA faces a challenge. Where do you stand? You have to make up your mind. Where do you stand? And here's the most famous part on 100, on page 110. I'll summarize that. I don't have to read it. You all know the story, where the Rav tells the story that he got the Shaila, and he repeats it a few times. There are a few versions. The version I heard, that the Shaila was from his brother-in-law. And what happened was, there was a big shul in Brookline, a big shul moving to Brookline. It had been Orthodox. And now it moves to the so-called suburbs. I don't know if I'm using the right terminology. I didn't grow up in Boston, but Jay, you can correct me if I'm wrong. And in moving and opening up new, the temple, mixed seating, going along with the crowd. And the Rav's brother-in-law had davened there. And now he couldn't daven there, and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is coming. There's no other shul in the community. It's just at the start of the exodus to the suburb. And he asked the Rav, what should I do in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur? Can I go in just to hear Tkiyat Shofar? And the Rav told him, absolutely not. I would still advise every Orthodox Jew to forgo Tefillah B'Tzibur even on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, rather than enter a synagogue with mixed pews, notwithstanding the fact that the officiating rabbi happens to be a graduate of a great and venerable yeshiva. No rabbi, how great in scholarship and moral integrity, has the authority to endorse, legalize, or even apologetically explain this basic deviation. I need not tell you that this is very, very powerful. And this is what the Rav is talking about. He's talking to the Rabbanim. He's giving testimony. He's negating the charges of the conservative rabbinate. And in a minute you'll see, I'll give you some of the names. These were prominent conservative rabbis. And in this letter to the RCA, he speaks once again that if you're going to let modernism and utilitarianism, utilitarianism control you, you'll do away with all of Yiddishkeit. Could you imagine putting to a vote if women should go to mikveh, taharat mishpacha? God have mercy, what the results would be. With the Shivan Kiyam and all that goes with it, we've had our problems in Israel already among so-called frum people. Imagine you're putting to a vote kashrut out of the house. People are traveling, and you all know the conservative movement. You can have fish in a treif restaurant. I mean, it's beyond comprehension. The very kalim you're reading on, Chaza was on there an hour earlier. It was cleaned off in the machine, I hope cleaned off, and they're serving you. If you're going to put it to a vote, all of Yiddishkeit will disappear. And here again, if the ethical norm, thou shalt not kill, has not lost its validity during the days of extermination camps and gas chambers, when millions of people were engaged in ruthless murder, but on the contrary, has been impregnated with deeper meaning and significance than every halachic maxim assumes greater import in times of widespread disregard and unconcern. That's one sentence. I'm losing my breath. But again, you hear what the Rav is saying, that the more the Nazis kill, the more important we should understand what it means, thou shalt not kill. And just because people want to take down the mechitza, chas v'chalila. And here he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Daled Amud Bet, 74b, that you will know at a time of Shmad, you're not even allowed to change the color of your shoelaces, right? If the Goyim used the color red and Jews wore black, you're not allowed to change to red, even if they threaten to kill you. It's a time of persecution, you must stand firm. And he says when it comes to the mechitza, it's the same concept. This is a time when everyone wants to get rid of the mechitza, and we have to stand firm. Okay, I want to go one more step further. And this, those of you who are older, this is very sad, but very true. I'm actually shaking right now, because I have a Talmud who's a dear, dear Talmud. I told you, it's a very unique Talmud. There's no other Talmud I have among my tens of thousands of Talmidim. This is a Talmud whose father was my mother-in-law's Talmud in the early 30s in Yeshiva Torah Chaim. And he's a son, and he was my Talmud about 50 years ago, and we remain very close until today. And he had a very hard life as far as death goes. While he was a teenager growing up, his older brother, 2 years older, died in high school of cancer. His mother never could get over the loss of a son, which is understandable. She died. And lo aleinu, he married a lovely girl. We read they met actually at some of our lectures. And she died young after 3 children. And now his second wife, as we speak, the doctors have given up already. It's, corona, and she's not the strongest lady, and heart problems, and Muncie, Good Samaritan Hospital, the Eibishter should help the Refuah Shleima. Let me just mention her name. She's from a Hasidic family, so it's a long name, Ruchama Perel Malkaleya Bat Chana Serel Refuah Shleima. And, when you have a happy marriage, and everyone should be able to work out a happy marriage. Again, it's one of our great problems of modern times. I've spoken about this at great length with all the sources, all the Makorot, the Rambam, Hilchot Ishit, Perek Tetvav, Palach Yutet, Palach Rechav. We're very self-centered. This, too, is a part of modern life. No one that I taught in the last 50 years at least, ever shared a bed with his brother. But I remember people who came from the other side of the ocean and they shared beds with their brothers, sisters shared beds. I remember someone born in Shanghai and she was very upset with Ephraim Zurab's book on Var Hatzalah because he says the Var Hatzalah favored the yeshiva people in Shanghai, which they had a right to do. No one realized at that time that Hitler was out to kill every man, woman, and child. It's in 1941. They did realize it a year later, and their policies changed. But anyway, she said, I don't know what they meant. My father was a yeshiva bacha in Shanghai, and she said, I slept in a carton under my parents' bed. You follow? There was no room what people went through. And you work out a happy marriage. A happy marriage is not easy to work out because we're very spoiled. We grew up. You fellas, at least two of you, had your own cars. Your own cars. Who ever heard of such a thing? One house, three cars, four. It's beyond comprehension. You had your own TVs, your own computers, you know, life moves on. You never shared. Who ever heard of it? And your mother, she served you food that you like. You had a good mother, she ruined you. Everyone else ate pizza and you had spaghetti. All right, you got to be out of your mind, but that's life. But willy-nilly, it affects us. When you marry, you're two different people, and by definition, Adam correlates a lot more, and you have to work it out that no, your first concern is your wife, and her first concern is her husband. So lo pashut. But you see the rav here, this is so sad and so true. The rav talks about that the entire concept of mixed pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. Prayer means communion with the master of the world. And you don't want to interfere women, men, thoughts. There is a certain sexual tension in the world. I need not tell you there were good Jews, great Rabbanim, who walked on the street with their eyes down. Of course, nowadays, if you walk with your eyes down, you're not going to survive because the car will take care of you. But you know how many tshuvot have been written about riding in the New York subway during the summer where women get on the subway. You're lucky they're still wearing clothes. There was one case a few years ago, it went to court, a woman wanted the right to come on without, she shouldn't have to wear a blouse, a bra, nothing. Men walk in, they don't have anything above their pants. She wants the same right. Thank God the judge ruled against her, which is a miracle. In Israel, if it reached the Supreme Court, they wouldn't rule against her. Lo aleinu. That's why you have to become citizens and vote. We have to change this idiotic system where a moron in the Supreme Court, you don't know who this man is, Hanan Meltzer with the demonstrations on Balfour Street said, show me evidence that one person died as a result of the demonstrations. Do you know that Rechavya was read? Where the heck did it get read from, if not the demonstrations? And you know who this man is? Hanan Meltzer. It's a great nephew of Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. When people live Torah, you become like an animal. You have no Torah values, ultimately no human values. It's just me, right, civil rights, fascist, self-aggrandizement, etc. God have mercy. It's a quote last week. It's not ancient history. Show me evidence that one person died. And the Haredim at a funeral, you go crazy that they're killing each other. Show me evidence. Ribbono shel Olam, who's dying in Israel? Every day, just yesterday, what was last night? What was the statistic? 11, 12 died. We're over 2,000, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not mistaken. We're over 2,000. Right or wrong, Yomo?
Closer to 1,200.
God have mercy. Yeah, you hear the statistic? God have mercy. And so the Rav, that's one reason. We don't, at a time of davening, we want the head to be holy, sanctified, concentrating on prayer. But the Rav says something else. This is sad. The Pasuk he quotes from Tehillim 123:2. Kuf Chaf Gimel Bet. Tehillim. Psalms. Hine kene avodim al yad adonehem. Behold, as the eyes of servants look unto the hand of their master, as the eyes of a maiden unto the hand of her mistress, our eyes look unto the Lord our God until he will be gracious unto us. And the Rav says so beautifully, when we approach God, we have to feel we're just a servant. We're in his hands. There's nobody else. A woman has to feel she's like a maid servant. There's no one else. You see, in a happy marriage, what do we lean on? We lean on each other. I always had the feeling my wife, nothing can stop her. Support, insight, wisdom. You lean on in each other. The male, the husband, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, certain Nora. It's only he can do it. Only he can inspire. Only he can lead. Only he can decide. And you lean on each other. You become one unit. And the thought of death, of parting, is very difficult. Very difficult in a happy marriage. What does the Gemara say in Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Bet? When a husband dies, a wife dies, Churban Habayit Biyamav. It's Churban Beit HaMikdash. What? There's some people don't want to even go into it. There's cynics. I remember in 1977 at the RCA convention, the Rav eulogized his wife. It's 10 years since she died. He spoke about it, tears. And I remember when I came outside of the lecture hall, there were some of the rabbis were outdoing each other in their cynicism, their sarcasm. One Rav, I still remember him, I see him before my eyes. Oy, if my Macha Shefa will go, I'll dance a kazatska on her grave. Quote, end quote. I remember Rabbi Yeruchim Gerela came out and Rabbi Yeruchim looks at me, he's still crying, it's so many years. My dear students, in a happy marriage, you're never the same again. You are never the same again. All right, you have to go further, the Lebedika Dafkin Vaita, you're alive, you have to go further, have to achieve, have to do, God has kept you alive, but you're never the same again. That's Churban Beis HaMikdash, Tisha B'Av is Tisha B'Av. And that's a happy marriage. And the Rav says the concept of mixed seating, that a husband and wife should be next to each other, is the total contradiction of what prayer is about. Vayon, hine, what is the sentence? Hine, keine avodim al yad adonehem. Keine shivcha al yad gevirta. Kain einenu el Hashem Elokeinu ad sheyachaneinu. And wow, this is so powerful, emotional, theologically, philosophically, it's irrefutable. Unfortunately, in our times, not everyone has this schut. We have, I just got a call yesterday, I don't know, my female students are rejoicing over that article in Ami. You might think Mashiach came. Oh, are they happy? So they're filling me in, and these were girls I taught in the early 70s from the finest Orthodox homes. Their parents were world famous. Michalah had a monopoly at that time. It's not like today when there are 1,000 different institutions. And I hear the story about this lady, marriage one, marriage two, and all right. This is what Chazal say, that the Gemara in Sota Daf Bet Amud Aleph, this first and second marriage, they're not the same. The first marriage is min Hashamayim, decreed. The second marriage, right, lefi masav. You understand? They're already, you're accomplished. And this is Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, the Rav used to tell the story and break into laughter. Binyamin, I'm giving you a special gift now, okay? This is from the Rav in a moment of levity, and he tells the story how Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was happily married, the great Rabbi Isaac Elchanan, and his wife died. And women lined up from Kovner all the way to the United States to marry him. One woman more beautiful than the other, one woman wealthier than the other, and this woman from a very wealthy home, and she had been proposed for him the first time around, and he heard about her. He said, fine. And she came to look at him. And when she came to look at him, this is what the Rav said, he was eating in the kitchen, and she peeked the door, opened it to peek at him, and he wasn't using a fork like he did. It wasn't the so afar, the Derech Eretz that she grew up with. And she said, it's not for me. Second time around, Chan Inspector, you mention his name, you have to stand up. Ribbono Shel Olam, who are we talking about? And the whole yeshiva named after him, and a guy named Rakefet. How many lectures did he give? How much did he publish on Reb Yitzchok Chanan? And she now comes and wants to marry him. And he says, if I wasn't good enough for you the first time around, I'm not good enough for you the second time around. And the Rav would break into laughter. But this is Ein Hachinami, the Gemara in Saita, Daf Bet Amid Aleph. But a happy marriage, wow. And you daven, you have to break that feeling. You're an individual, you stand before God on your own. And the Rav described with his own wife how she was ill, 67. I don't know what happened here. Yomo, come. Oh, we're back on again. Okay, and with his own wife, 60.
Is being recorded.
And with his own wife in 67.
One second. Muted.
Okay. Unmute. Hello? Do you hear it there?
Oh, he's calling me.
Do you have to tell Yomo?
Can you please unmute? Can you please unmute Rabbi Kevin?
Mori? He doesn't hear. Mori? Can you... Wait, there's Mori.
Can you please unmute Rabbi Kevin?
Okay. Do you hear me? Shake your head if you hear me. Okay? Do you hear me? Okay. And when we stand before God, we have to stand as individuals. And the Rav described, this is where he was mourning his wife, how helpless he felt when he went to visit her in the hospital. And here's his wife, his beloved wife, his Eshet Chayil, the mother of his daughter, children. And he can't help her. He can't save her. Can't do anything for her. Just can view her. All he can do is daven. And this is so powerful, so overwhelming. Okay. So you can understand already, the Rav has now become a public figure. The Rav has gone to war, gone to battle for the Mechitza. His testimony, he deals with the conservative rabbinate, he refutes, and he says something else at the end, and very important as well. Growing up in America at that time, you felt very depressed. How many Jews were Shomer Shabbos? How many Jews? The New York Times didn't give a hoot about the Torah world. It's not like today, where immediately there was an article this week on Meir Sharim, their secret hospitals underground, how the Haredim don't go to the hospitals, but they bring the oxygen to you. My daughter had told me about this, and someone in Shul, who's in the medical business, and he told me about it, and lo and behold, there's the New York Times with this whole article on the hospital underground of the Haredi world. Who cared about Haredim? Who cared about Rabbanim? And you could be depressed. And the Rav says, don't feel depressed. Conservatives in the mid-50s were conquering the world. We have not yet lost the battle, for we have not yet begun to fight. We have but abandoned the synagogue, much as the French abandoned Paris before the Germans fired the very first shot. Even today, however, we can yet defend our positions if we will but have the determination. We must have the will to give battle for the synagogue, to give battle for the synagogue as the center of Jewish communal life in this country. No movement or organization is as strong as the synagogue. When we lose a house of prayer, we lose a strategic position. A right battle for principles is always worthy and an honorable endeavor. So what the Rebbe is saying here Don't let the fact that we're a minority, don't let the fact that we have lost synagogues, don't let the fact that the conservative movement is expanding. We have to fight. We have to stand firm. We have to have dignity. Now, I want to say I wanted to check out what remains of Baruch Litman's family. I see him before my eyes. He came to the yeshiva the year I got smicha, 1961. And he gave out, I have an inscribed copy from him, he gave out every musmach a copy of the sanctity of the synagogue. He only asked that you promised you would not take a non-mechitza position. So I went online and I found his granddaughter, Naomi Litwin, is an author. She wrote a book, The Masada Factor. She writes about her grandfather. You can't see it. There's a picture here where she's standing with Reb Baruch, with her grandfather, with a beard behind his library. But she says, we have not just my grandfather in the family, but my Zaidi's nephew, second cousin Jerry, who is Jerome Letvin, born Chicago 1920, Jerry is a distinguished cognitive scientist and a professor emeritus of electrical and bioengineering and communications physiology at the Masters Institute of Technology, MIT. I don't even know what those words mean, but it seems... what he is best known for in our family is that he was the first person to utter an expletive on television during his famous debate with acid head Timothy Leary. Leary, infamous for coining the phrase, turn on, tune in, drop out. And she gives you a link to that debate, and I have to give her cousin credit. It's a word I don't want to use in public, although the Israeli newspapers are so stupid. They transliterate the word into Hebrew letters, and they use it all the time. But he got so angry at this Leary that he said to him, you're full of baloney, you're full of bull, you can fill in the real word. And I give him credit, I agree 100%. I don't believe he's alive, 1920, halavai. And if Naomi Litwin is well and listening, or someone can tell her, we really admire her grandfather. Now, the way it was originally reported, when all was said and done, you'll see what the victory was and why I used the word Pyrrhic. And since I used that word, I've seen the word Pyrrhic in Hebrew transliteration a few times over already. The Michigan Supreme Court, this is the JTA, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency Bulletin. This is for all the newspapers, right? What happened? June 15th, 1959. The Michigan Supreme Court ended a four-year dispute involving Congregation Bet Tefillat Moses in Mount Clemens when it voted unanimously last Friday to forbid mixed seating during religious services at the synagogue. And it goes on, it describes the judge, and it describes the issue, and speaks about Baruch Litwin. Mr. Litwin, who claims to have spent $12,000 of his personal funds in battling the suit for 4 years, stated that the court's decision was not a personal triumph, but a victory for Orthodox Judaism. However, a spokesman for the Board of Trustees of the synagogue, interviewed by Frank Simons for the Detroit Jewish News, implied that in the future, nearly every one of the 75 member families would join in forming a new congregation. Now, this is a quote. Mr. Litwin's victory has won him a congregation, but lost him the congregants. Has won him a decision that has cost him the friendship of the rabbi of the synagogue. Remember, this is an Orthodox rabbi. And nearly every family in the Mount Clemens community. has won him a court case that gives him use of a building that prohibits mixeding, but lost dominion to conduct services, the board member said. And this is true. It's sad. But many times in these victories, it was only on paper. The people couldn't care less. It's America. We pay our nickel. We take our choice. And they walked away, went down the block, bought a plot of land, built the Kavod HaTiferet, a big conservative temple, and the little Orthodox synagogue struggled for a minyan. Nowadays, Baruch Hashem, it's just the opposite. The conservative temples are closing, merging. You don't have a better example than in Queens, where three conservative temples merged. They're in Hillcrest. And remember, I told you, I don't think they allow a man into the temple. The rabbi's a woman, the chazanit is a woman, and the mankalit is a woman. And tremendous parking lot, open on Shabbos, and they drive all over from the island, Queens, to worship conservative. And in every street corner, including one block away, is a Bukharan shul in Queens, in Hillcrest. On the other side of the street is a Rebbe with a shtibel. Three blocks away is the tremendous Young Israel of Hillcrest. On the other side is the Georgian shul of Hillcrest, took over the conservative temple. So Baruch Hashem, we have seen miracles in our times. But remember, this was 55, this is the Rav, this took courage. He led the battle. He became a leader, not quiet, not reticent, not retiring, not keeping away from the public thoroughfare. He's the Rav, and he accepts the responsibility that goes with it. Now, I'm quoting now from page 73, where there's a whole description of what went on in these two battles. And two of the most prominent conservative rabbis who testified, I want to speak about them for a moment, Dr. Jacob Biegas and Dr. David Aronson. Dr. Jacob Biegas of Baltimore, it's one of the sad stories of where we lose out. And the times are different. It's 100 years ago. Studied at the yeshiva in the 20s into the 30s. Actually, it's 90 years ago. He's more Talmud in the 30s. A Talmud Muvhak of Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik. A Talmud Muvhak of Rabbi Revel. He had a part of the Agus family. The Agus, it's originally Agushevitz, the family. Later they Americanized the name. At least many members Americanized it to Agus. A-G-U-S. The person that I did my M.A. under was his brother, Erwin Agus, Avraham Yitzchak Agus. And there was a third brother, a medical doctor, and there were more members of the family. There was one who just sat in the public library in 42nd Street and knew Kol HaTorah Kula. Mark Steiner, Professor Mark Steiner, who died, one of the early victims of Corona, Lo Aleinu, I still can't get over it. So Mark and I, our mothers, went to kindergarten together. Mark did a lot of publications on this Agushevitz, who wrote endlessly in Yiddish, and he translated into Hebrew, I believe it is. And this man, if I recall correctly, Mark told me, never married, and knew Kol HaTorah Kula, just sat and learned all day in the big public library in 42nd Street that has a very rich Judaic collection. And of course, Agus now is not just a conservative rabbi, he's a Reconstructionist rabbi. Rabbi Aronson was a typical graduate of the seminary, lived to 96 years old, president of the Rabbinical Assembly. Typical story, born in Russia, came to America when he was yet a youngster, studied in Columbia University, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and went into the rabbinate, and ultimately remained in Minneapolis, for decades and decades, built a tremendous temple. Later in life, he moved to Los Angeles to be near his children. That's where he died, published a very important volume from the conservative point of view, The Jewish Way of Life. It became a classic. It was reprinted many times, and he was probably an example of a conservative rabbi, centrist, historic school. It's not a Reconstructionist. Jacob Akers had moved more to the left. And of course, they went on, their biggest argument, they raised the point that some Orthodox rabbis are found in the pulpits of mixed pews congregations. How can you be against mixed pews if your own members, rabbis, are in them? And the OU witnesses were called. They made an RCA people, Rabbi Hollander, who was then president of RCA, David Hollander, made it very clear that these rabbis accepted such calls only under circumstances of urgent necessity to preserve the congregation for Orthodox Judaism. Each of these rabbis affirms that our religious law does not permit mixed seating and devotes its efforts to restoration of the sanctity of the synagogue by reintroduction of the separation of the sexes during worship. Now, so, all right, this is a moot point. It can be viewed either way. But this was the know-how, the practice in the Torah world at that time. As I told you, when I got smicha, they asked me one question: if I'm willing to take a shul without a mechitza. It's the only question. And then if you were willing, they'd propose something, you would go to the Rav, and they would tell you, all right, take it for 2 years, and I don't have to go any further. This is the story with one of our greatest rabbis who come out of the yeshiva a little bit after this period, Rabbi Steve Riskin. And Steve Riskin was, people came to Dr. Belkin, and they were unhappy with the conservative temples on the Upper West Side, and they want to organize a conservative temple which will be more learning-oriented. And Rabbi Belkin turns to Steve Riskin, he already as a student, as a youngster, was already teaching in Jewish Studies program. We want you to take it, all right? He goes to the Rav, whatever, I don't want to go into all the details now. And finally they agree, he takes the shtela, not as the rabbi, but as educational director. You got to give him credit. And he never davened there when there was no mechitza. He davened in some shtibel on the west side. Then he came and conducted learning sessions. And you know what happened? They decided they want him as rabbi, real rabbi, full-time rabbi. And they agreed to put a mechitza in. All right, it began with a small mechitza, 40, 50 inches. No different than the mechitza at Jewish Center, where Rabbi Young was, Rabbi Lamb was. And today you go into the shul, there's a big mechitza there. It's a different world. And you got to give credit. But Chas v'Chalila, he never said that davening without a mechitza was permissible, never advocated it. And that's the typical story of that period. Now, what else happened at the trials and at the cross-examinations? This too is very fascinating, because the conservative movement tried to claim it was halachically oriented. Yes, we believe in halacha, we accept halacha, but there is a concept of historical Judaism, a concept of Catholic Israel. Again, you have to go, Binyamin, you have to hear my lectures go on YU Torah. What do you think? I'm lecturing on the history of Judaism in America and I didn't deal with the Lubavitcher Rebbe for 2 years? Why do you think Lubavitcher honored me last year? You know what they told me? Many told me of the big shots there. The ones, they said those were the greatest lectures given on the Rebbe by someone who was not a chassid. With insight, there are reasons why. You'll understand if you hear the lectures. I had a direct connection. But here, they claim that we listen, Catholic Israel, what is Catholic Israel? That's Solomon Schechter, remember? And Catholic Israel, what does Catholic mean? When I was a kid, I used to hear that Solomon Schechter believed in Catholic Israel. I used to think he's a Catholic. Catholic Israel is universal Israel. It's a fancy phrase that he coined for the concept of Imlo Nevi'im Hein B'nei Nevi'im, that the ultimate arbiter of Jewish law are the Jewish people, Catholic Israel. Ira Kefet dealt with that in great length. It's not for now. But they claim they're from that. We have a right that there was a mechitza, but now in the United States you don't need a mechitza, you don't want a mechitza, you want to retract, and there's nothing wrong with it. So they started questioning them, and they had to admit. In cross-examination, the imposing conservative rabbis admitted, one, they permit travel on the synagogue by car or any other conveyance. And you got to remember, this is the mid-50s. That original tshuva came out in the early 50s. And if permit travel to the synagogue, wow, how do you call that halacha? They do not consider the laws of mikveh and family purity binding, though they admitted that this is contrary to the written law, the simple text of Scripture. And you all understand, everyone made this big argument in the United States of America, we have a shower, we have a bathtub. You don't need a mikveh. And I need not tell you, when you break down mikveh, God have mercy what you're breaking down. And it's one of our biggest problems today, that you don't realize our problem here with the education in the Mamlachti Dati system. It's not that the Haredim have their problems. Believe me, they have their problems. Right now, a noticeable percentage of Haredim are simply murderers, right stream. But they have their problems. But we have our problems too. And one of the big problems, because these kids are exposed to dual culture, we don't put them into a ghetto, we have boys and girls living together, experimenting, see if it works. Like, they look at this normally. It's God have mercy. When you abolish mikveh, abolish tarat mas mishpacha, abolish the sanctity of the synagogue, the problems that we create. And by the way, even in our own marriage, tarat mishpacha is the greatest gift that God gave you, because your wife is a different color every month. The Gemara in Masechet Nida, Habiba Balalav, Kishat Kenisatala Chuppah. I don't have to tell you what that means. So they admit, we don't need mikveh today. They do not consider the laws of mikveh and family purity binding. Unbelievable. They admit it in public. No, how do you say you believe in halacha? Number three, they held only a qualified belief, if any, in the divine revelation. And you know this too, Maimir HaSinai. Today, people know it wasn't Maimir HaSinai. It's a gradual development. It's only God gave 10 commandments. There wasn't Torah Shabbatah. There wasn't Torah Shabbatah. Many authors, the Holiness Code. I don't have to tell you what circulates in these circles. They asked Dr. Agis to read and to translate from a prayer book the eighth principle of the faith of Maimonides, which states that the whole Torah now in our possession is the same one that was given to Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher. He admitted that he believes in it not verbatim, but only according to his interpretation, which is not accepted by orthodox authority. All right, that's he admitted out front. Dr. Aronson stated that the 13 principles of faith that Maimonides coined are not required if you want to be, you can be an Orthodox Jew even if you don't believe in them. And by the way, you know, modern times, Professor Kellner of Haifa University, my student, Professor Mark Shapiro, have written some interesting work where they show that there are many people, many Rishonim, philosophers who differ with Maimonides. They're not Yud Gimli Karim, they're Gimli Karim. Maybe it could be only one Ikar, Kadosh Baruch Hu. It's not binding, different interpretations. But Pesach HaKol, the Yud Gimli Karim, as formulated by the Rambam, are the basis of our belief. You can modify, you can add, but you certainly can't walk away and say, I don't accept it. And it goes on and on with the debate and with this whole problem of the rabbis in RCA with mikshtelas. So they brought expert testimony from the RCA. The Rabbinical Council of America would not maintain the membership of a rabbi who considers mixed seating permissible by Jewish law. And of course, this becomes very, very important because even a non-Jewish judge can understand there's a difference between a certain reality and at least the theology, the commitment. And lachatchila, when you have in the Constitution that the shul has to be Orthodox, that the shul has to have a mechitza, you do not have the right to take it down. Even if you can show there are Orthodox shuls, so-called, without mechitza, the rabbis are there, there are shuls with mixed seating, the rabbis are there, RCA, but all this is not proper, it's not correct, it's not what we're talking about when we say orthodoxy. It's a compromise with a certain reality, but if the shul charter reads it has to be orthodox, it has to follow the Polish ritual, the Russian ritual, then Allah had kama v'kama, you're not allowed to remove it. And these decisions became very basic later in life when you have, for instance, what happened in Queens with the Hillcrest Jewish Center, I believe it was called, and Holliswood Jewish Center, it's on the boulevard right before you enter the parkway, and Utopia Parkway Jewish Center, that's what it was called. And remember I told you the story that they began an Orthodox minyan downstairs as Hillcrest changed, and they asked Rabbi Heschel Schechter, who today is such an important posek in the United States, certainly in our world, and they asked Rabbi Heschel, can you be a man, to us the conservative temple said, we'll let you have your own Orthodox minyan, but you have to be members of the temple. And they asked Rabbi Heschel, and he said, there's nothing wrong, you've joined the temple, you make your minyan downstairs, and over the years, there was no one left upstairs, the downstairs moved upstairs, and they had to vote, they were members, and one lady went to court that she had contributed so much money over the years, and it was a conservative temple, and she has the right to daven next to her husband. She would come back, she was living in Florida, ready to come back, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the summer, and she gave tens of thousands of dollars to, it was the opposite, to a conservative temple, a trust. And there they went to court, and you should know that a lot of what happened previously becomes a source for their case. And here they had to prove the opposite, that a conservative temple can have a mechitza. You follow? It already went totally 180% to the other side. And they had the greatest proof in the world. They went to the seminary, and at the seminary, there was always a minyan where Professor Liebman davened, and Professor Finkelstein davened, oh, and perhaps Professor Heschel, there was always a minyan with a mechitza. Well, if in JTS, the hotbed of conservative Judaism, there can be a minyan with a mechitza, then we can have a minyan here with a mechitza, and it doesn't interfere with the conservative heritage. So it's come full cycle. What's amazing is the Reform movement, and this I have to thank my Talmud Steve Przensky, Reverend Przensky informed me that they passed the law that you're not allowed to daven at a minyan where it's separate men. It's an affront to the women that you're not allowed. You follow? Ad kedei kach. Have they come full cycle in where they stand as Jews before God? My dear students, first of all, I nimodeh l'Kadosh Baruch Hu that everything works. I have to thank Yomo and Rabbi Bednash and Danny, YU. It was not my problem, it's a problem with this room. And I hope that this system, which they now upgraded, if I'm using the right word, Yomo, that will continue to work, because it's much easier for me to teach in the classroom with my microphone. I even have a few students looking at me here. I have to make a shachiyanu after so many months where all I could see was Ali's face on the screen. Yesterday was a very hard day for me. The morning took my strength away. I came home totally wiped out with all the Akmas Nefesh of the shear, of being cut off once, twice, thrice. And the phone calls I got, and the illness, it's not easy to deal with it. And I just pray for Ruchama Pearl. I know her as Pearl, Pearly. God should be kind. The doctors have given up, but I hope the Ribbono Shel Olam hasn't given up. It hurts. And I still haven't gotten over my classmate, Abe Mandelbaum. All of us, we call him one of the sweetest guys alive. You have to remember. Leona, and imagine at least they're not separate, they were joined together. She died on Wednesday, Chol HaMoed, and he died on Yisru Chag Sunday, our Yisru Chag. Let me not mix up Simiyat Seres and Simchas Torah again. What did we do today? We dedicated this year in honor of the full recovery of Chief Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, a great Jew, a great individual. The Eibishter, the Ribbono Shel Olam, should help and he should have a full recovery. Mm-hmm. And I join with all the YU people, the OU people, the RCA people, praying together, and whatever Divrei Torah we said today from the Rav, we said some important Divrei Torah, should be a schut for his refuah shleima. We spoke about the Rav, we spoke about his testimony, we spoke about the conflict, we spoke about the Pyrrhic victory. We have set the stage. Next week's shiur is very fascinating. A photograph of YU circa 1980, the swing to the right, what's happening in America. And that sets the stage for the greatest battle ever fought in America, the battle over Synagogue Council, New York Board of Rabbis. Okay, hold on. I want to say something else. Baruch atah Adonai Melech Haolam, Mashiach Kol Nehi Eved V'Rav. I want to say one of the latest traditions. This is summer 2020. It's volume 52, number 3. So I have to say, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein's children are being interviewed all over. Did anyone here see the weekend Makori Shon? Moshe Lichtenstein was interviewed, the Rosh Yeshiva, one of the three Rosh Yeshivas in Har Etzion. And wow, Rabbi Yoshua, my Talmud, Har Etzion graduate, I never realized how left he is. He was in favor of leaving Gush Katif, and even till this day he speaks of compromise. I was overwhelmed, but he's entitled to his opinion. He's an Adam Gadol, he's a Talmud Chacham, he's a Yerei Shemayim. He was interviewed. His interview, I was reading, and I was, have to admit, I was suffering. But all right, I have a right to suffer. I remember when he was a gleam in his parents' eyes, we'll put it that way. We go back a long way. He heard me speak on Yonah Bamel on the Shleshim. He hugged me, he embraced me, I think he even kissed me. So at least he understood me, and I understand him, but we're entitled to different opinions on that issue, on right-wing politics. I have a different point of view altogether, that God gave us Eretz Yisrael, which he speaks about, and if we get back more of the land, we're not allowed to relinquish it. And we see a person has to, I'm going to write this about the Rav, this is very important to me, Yosef Yechav, I mean, I'm just alluding to it, the rubric, that we see what happened after leaving Gush Katif. We have to be a lot smarter in the future. But what I wanted to mention is, in this tradition, there's an interview with Reb Moshe's sister, Tanya Mittelman. This is women in the Torah world and the thought of Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. And this article I both enjoyed and suffered with. I enjoyed, on one hand, she presents her father's point of view, and if it wouldn't be the name Aaron Lichtenstein, put in the name Aaron Rakefet. It's exactly my point of view. Can't get over it, but all right, we both learned by the Rav. We both grew up in the same era. He, Reb Aaron, learned, but I'm ready to say the babe, but I don't want to, it's Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, all right? I knew him as the babe. The babe learned with Reb Yitzchak Kuttner. Ani Rothkopf spent some time in Lakewood, learned with Reb Aaron Kuttner. So our views are very similar. And both of us are struggling. In other words, on one hand, as I mentioned yesterday, we're willing to open Kala Torah Kula to women. I even said, Machon Gold, I remember when women demanded certain courses, I said, as long as there are 10 women who want this course, Machon Gold has to hire a teacher who's an expert. They have Kala Torah Kula, whatever they want. Women today, if they can be surgeons, if my dermatologist is my dear student from Michlalar, 83, 84, and she today saves my face, if you recall how red it was a few years ago. If she gets, if someone wants to be a gedola in learning, absolutely. But where do we draw the line? And we're struggling. Reb Aaron got questions. I got questions. And we're struggling. We have to, it's a work in process. Where do we draw the line? And you've heard my point of view. I don't think I have to apologize. I think everyone will agree. I'm quite a conservative with a small c. And yet I don't want to push women who are intellectually challenged away. And I've come up with my solutions, more or less what the synagogue, what the OU came out with in their famous response to this question. More or less, it's exactly what a guy named Rakefet said in classes in this very room. What gave me a challenge and bothered me is that Tanya describes her father, but she wants more. She wants more. And here you can see, this is a woman steeped in Torah, raised by Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, raised by Dr. Tova, the daughter of Mori Moreno Verabenu. She's steeped in Torah, but you can see already she wants more. There's certain hints there in what she says. So I have to say I recommend the article. It's food for thought. We're not going to solve the problem overnight. Finally, see, this is where I suffer. Will the students who are in here come closer? Come closer. There's a wall separating us. You have to see what this room looks like. And this is the picture that was sent to me, the class of 1923. This is the Meitzer Te'ilui. This is Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. This is Rabbi Tenle's father. Could you imagine? He got smicha 21. Look at his face. It's exactly the face of Reb Moshe David Tendler. It's absolutely his father. This is Rabbi Solomon Reichman. It can be nobody else. I recognize that face 100%. And I checked. He was a 1923 musmach. He later goes on to what we spoke about in class. He was the Heksha King with Rabbi Chalap. Chalap and Reichman, that was the famous Heksha before the OU. The other people identified here, this is Rabbi Menachem Peer, the father, I think his name is Rabbi Yechiel Peer of Far Rockaway. And this is Rabbi Mordechai Stern, number one. Rabbi Mordechai Stern. He was Rav, if I'm not mistaken, in Queens. they were Chashuba Rabbanim. Who the others are, they're trying, if you can contact children or grandchildren, you may be able to get some identity. But when this picture was sent to me, only the Mechita was identified. So I get the Skut, Rabbi Rosenberg, and Rabbi Reichman. The others come because they were interrelated. Rabbi Per, and somehow he's Machatonim with Machatonim of Rabbi Tendler. And Rabbi Stern, I think his son told the person working on this, or grandson, that was Rabbi Stern. Let's see who else we identify. It's always a challenge. A beautiful, beautiful picture. Now, you have to ask one question. Where was Rabbi Revel?
Yeah.
And that's the answer is very simple. Rabbi Revel at that time was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, working, trying to salvage his family's business. And Rabbi Rosenberg was the head of the yeshiva, the titular head. But this is a moment in time. Yeshivas v'chanan, the mecha to Eli. Wow. So, Be'ezrat Hashem, this picture should be published. And just like everyone in the right-wing art school world goes crazy against Rakefet because he published the picture of the Reb Shimon Shkup sitting with the graduates of 1929. It appears in the work, Revel, Bernard Revel. We'll have another picture proving the Mechita to us in the yeshiva. Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for your participation, honoring me with your presence. I should say gentlemen and lady. I see Esther on the screen. And Be'ezrat Hashem, next Sunday we pick up again with the high point, the crescendo, where Chaim Soloveitchik, word by word, says exactly what the Mishnah Halachot says. And I also want to quote more from Chaim because it's sort of an introduction to what we're going to do one day afterwards on Monday. And until we meet again in health and happiness, Das V'danya. Morty, can you open it? Everyone can unmute.
The recording has stopped.
Are there any questions? Any questions? Yes, Binyamin.
Rebbe?
Yeah, 1 second. Someone's asking. One second, Mark. Binyamin.
Why did the road, the Pasuk at the Hillel, why do you think it was so essential for a man and a woman to be separate, even though they're married?
You shouldn't fool yourself that you can save your wife and she can fool you. Before God, you're an individual. That's the Pasuk at the Hillel. Yes, Mark Wiener, right? Who started this?
What was one of the major breaks between the conservative movement and orthodoxy was when a portion of them started using the terminology of divinely inspired. That once they could open the door by saying the Matan Torah was different, it was divinely inspired as opposed to the dictation, that open the Pandora's box for them basically doing whatever they wanted.
Well, let's put it this way. If you're going to take a centrist conservative position, they believed in Matan Torah. That they did believe. But the oral Torah was a historical development. And once it becomes historical development, Dar can change whatever they want. And that was the whole concept of Catholic Israel, that ultimately Torah Sheval Peh, who develops it, who makes the decisions? The Jew on the ground. Now, this is why I never use the word halachic development. I personally coined the term, and people who are learned love it, dynamics of halacha. Because we believe Torah Sheval Peh was given at the same time. The principles were there. Yes, you do have a right throughout the generations to apply them, but those are the dynamics of the halacha, and it has to be within the halacha context. So I think that right there is the tremendous difference our approach to Torah Sheval Peh. Divine inspiration or divine guidance or divine revelation, most conservative Jews, when conservative movement was powerful, most rabbis, let's say, because the average layman doesn't know anything in America, most rabbis believed, and I still hope they believe, in the written Torah as being divine. However, I'm not certain. I have to be honest with you. The New York Times had an article when they permitted women their homosexuals and lesbians to be rabbis, which followed after they permitted women. So the New York Times interviews a student at the seminary, and the author, the interviewer says to him, the writer, the reporter is probably the right word, the reporter says to him, but it's a sentence in the Old Testament against homosexuality. He said, and the young rabbi answers, is this the first sentence we changed? We changed other sentences, so we can change this too. So I don't know today whether it's correct that the majority of students at the seminary believe in the written Torah as divine inspiration or divine revelation. I don't know. I hate to say, but I have a feeling I doubt it, because what they've done with halacha is just beyond comprehension. Okay, anyone else with a question?
Yes, Rabbi.
Yeah, go ahead.
There is a video of Rav Riskin speaking before Chabad, where he talked about talking with the Rav and the Rebbe before he started Lincoln Square, before he agreed to go there, and the three conditions that the Rav gave him when he went and going to Russia. It was all in one long video. It was split into several others. If I can find it, I'll send it to you.
Good, good.
It was online.
But what were the three conditions?
Also, Rabbi,
Nachum, yeah.
They came out, the OU issued Sanctity of the Synagogue in the 1980s, and there are a bunch of essays in the back, like added, that one of them is Rabbi Riskin.
We're not hearing you clearly, Nachum. We're not hearing you. Oh, okay. All right, let me wish everyone well. We have to clear the room out. There's another class coming in, and we should just have Besora Tovot, Oleinu Val Kol Yisrael. Once again, I thank you. You honor me, and I'm so happy to see live students, Kanayin Hara.
The Russian story is interesting also.
What Russia? With Steve Riskin. No, Beseda. Rabbi Riskin is one of a kind. Kalakavod. Lately, I have to say, he's moved more left. Hard for me to understand it, but I think the Israeli scene and the rabbinate here, I think it has turned him off a little and moved him more left. I certainly don't agree with some of his statements recently, but nevertheless, I cannot criticize him in public, because Steve is one of a kind, and what he did on the Upper West Side and what he did in bringing a Kehila and Aliyah, show me one other rabbi who accomplished what he did. Kol hakavod to him. So that's Rabbi Riskin, one of a kind. What do they call him? Stevie Wonder. It's a play on that musician, as I recall. And we knew him, I knew him as, in class as a kid. And he always was one step ahead of everyone else. That's all. Kol hakavod lo. He gave up a lot. You don't realize he had a very good mind. And he could have been a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a tremendous Rosh Yeshiva, but he went into the active rabbinate, that became his calling, and gave up his research and that aspect, the academic aspect. But look, there's freedom of choice, each individual is different, and each one has to choose where he's the happiest. I have to admit publicly, the worst or best thing that ever happened to me was when Rabbi Belkin and Ms. Davis kept their word, appointed me a Rosh Yeshiva, and I couldn't believe it. I'm teaching Shas, Paiskim, and I'm getting paid for it. And that really ruined me. It took me out of the rabbinate later in life. My grandson and I just had a discussion, because he told me what type of work he's looking for. And he said he doesn't want any administrative work, and I just wants to do what he wants to do, his art. And I told him, you're no different than your grandfather. I had so many offers over the years. I could have been wealthy, established, famous, well-known, big titles, and I turned every last one down. Why? Because it would have pulled me away from my desk. And all I can do in life is learn Torah and teach Torah. I hope I know a little bit, just a little. Keep on trying to learn more and more, Kol HaTorah Kula, and I hope I'm a good teacher. I want to thank you once again until we meet again, and health and happiness, and particularly the people who are awake in the middle of the night from New York, Chicago, Florida. Kol hakavod lechem. Das v'danya. Okay. Okay, Benjamin?
Okay.
Okay. Ellie, what are you going to do with him? He finished Miller's book on the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and he thinks he's getting involved with the Rebbe 2 years. Do me a favor. Are you married, Benjamin?
Yes, they have.
Great. Ask your wife if you can take off 2 years just to hear Rakefet's lectures on the history of Torah in the United States. Okay, Ellie, help him out. And let's see if we can convince her. By the way, you can bring your wife to class if she's free.
She's teaching right now in NMY.
In where?
NMY.
Oh, I hope
that. And Yeshua Moriah,
so. I helped organize that place. In Talpiot, she's in Talpiot now, right? Where is it?
In Baca. They're both in Baca now.
What do you mean, both?
Yeshua Moriah also.
She's in Midrashit Moriah?
Yeah, she's in both places.
And what do you mean both? It has two locations today?
No, I'm saying it was by Shaar HaTzedek, and they now moved to Baca.
Yeah, it was. That's ancient history. It went from Shaar HaTzedek, it went to Kiryat Yovel. Start, 1 second. Start Helmreich. I'm going to start. The person I'm quoting is one of the first people to die from Corona.
Rebbe, before the Lubavitcher Rebbe series, he's got to read Washington.
Absolutely.
My father-in-law was right in Washington. ABCs. Well,
if you haven't read Washington, you haven't breathed
there. You got to know how to breathe there in Washington.